from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium now through August.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the upcoming Dig In Food Festival at the White River State Park.
I'll chat with author Chris Huntington about his new novel.
And I'll have a look at this year's Feast of Lanterns. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Dig In, A Taste of Indiana is back for its second annual event on August 28th at White River State Park. Sharon Gamble was hungry for the celebration of Indiana food and beverage, so she invited Dig In's chief organizer, Eric Freeman, to tell us more.
So remind me where the idea of Dig In got started.
Oh, Sharon, it has a broad origin. The Indiana State Department of Agriculture funded Dig In last year, but it really was an idea that came together from Neil Brown, a local chef, Tom England, who runs the culinary department at Ivy Tech, Bob Witt, the director at White River State Park, who really is more of a foodie than he is the director of White River State Park.
If only he could get paid to be a foodie.
That's right, and he would love that, I think. Marcus Agresta, who runs the actually the delivery operation at Piazza Produce, was very interested in this too. But so a lot of different folks from a lot of different food angles came together to put this together. But the focus is Indiana ingredients to make Indiana dishes that are served to folks from Indiana who are interested in where does my food come from and who makes it at restaurants statewide.
This has been such an interesting conversation to watch develop over the last few years. It just feels as though there are so many more people, so many more food producers taking great care to make sure that we can, number one, grow food locally, create food locally, keep it pure, but also get it to local chefs and local restaurants, local outlets of all kinds.
Right.
It just feels like an exponential growth.
It really is. The buy local, the go local concept is alive and well statewide, really nationwide. It really is an idea whose time has come, and this Dig In really leverages that.
And your involvement is?
I am putting the second annual Dig In together, which will be the 28th of August, again in White River State Park at Celebration Plaza. So it's a great outdoor event, just one day, actually just one afternoon, noon to 5 on that day. And I am still in the process of pulling chefs together, wineries, breweries. It is all things Indiana. So Indiana beers, Indiana wines, Indiana water, Indiana root beer. India Chocola has come back. So Indiana produced Chocola.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to not only eat, but drink all things Indiana.
How do you get the word out? As we're having this conversation, it's still fairly early in July. How do you get the word out? Are there what are some of the professional associations that most food, I'm not even sure what language, food providers, food creators belong to?
You know, it's funny, Sharon. Indiana has an extensive food network, and all you really need to do is just put out the word that we're creating an event like this. And because the going local idea is so popular, the word just spread, and it really is easy to put a list of 125 chefs statewide that focus on local ingredients. Is not very difficult to do, which is great. It speaks a lot about Indiana and its food culture.
How do we compare to some other Midwest states anyway?
You know, Tom England at Ivy Tech was telling me that in some ranking, and he gave me the source, Indiana ranks 5th in terms of use of artisanal and local foods. 5th.
That's not bad at all.
Not at all. And I don't remember who was above us, but I remember New York State and Washington State were both in the top 5. But you hear so much about Indiana being 48th, 49th in rankings. I thought it was really interesting that we're 5th. That was great.
More people need to know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So when people come to Dig In, they will be getting modest samples, but like 2 ounce samples, but enough to taste.
Absolutely. We call them tastes, but really, Sharon, it's a misnomer. They're about, the serving's about the size of the palm of your hand. So it's significant. We hope to have 36 chefs total. So when you think about 36 tastes the size of the palm of your hand, you absolutely will leave full.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't eat lunch beforehand. Come hungry.
And samples of not just food, but of the beverages as well.
Absolutely. There will be free tastings of the beers and the wines. And then there will also be a tent where you can buy the beer and buy the wine.
Sure. Because you might need to rest in the middle of this feast.
Absolutely. On the 28th of August, you can just bet it's going to be hot. So just sit down and have something to drink would be a good idea.
Speaking of which, what are the logistics? The space at White River State Park where this takes place, what is the space, and is there lots of electrical available? Because I'm picturing just the mechanics of how the chefs are setting up and keeping fresh.
There is electric available there. A lot of the chefs don't necessarily need it. They'll make these tastes in their restaurants before they come. Most of them will. So they'll bring them, and then they will, you know, in a larger batch, and then break them into tastes right there so that they can talk to the guests as they pass them the taste. Piazza Produce also provides a couple of refrigerated trucks, so as the day goes by, the tastes that need to be kept cold will be kept cold, as will the wines, as will the beers. We were in Celebration Plaza, which is right in front of the NCAA Hall of Fame, and it's fenced off because of the concert series at White River State Park, so there's a natural fencing already there. The bridge between White River State Park and the zoo will be a children's area. We'll have extensive children's activities. That's sort of the new hook for this year's Dig In. So come and bring your children, and we'll have plenty for them to do that's agricultural related.
So I was just going to ask, so some of those will be educational
absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Related to food.
And all of it will be educational related to food. No bounce houses or anything like that. It will be make ice cream in a bag, plant lettuce seeds, and learn about, you know, how long will it take these to grow and how you can eat them and that kind of thing.
Brilliant. Get the next generation started before they even know that they have choices.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Obviously, the target audience is anybody who's interested in food, end user foodies like me, like you. But who else do you want to attract? Do you want to attract restaurateurs who are maybe not doing the slow food movement, the local food movement, or maybe aren't aware as much of what's available locally? Who are you targeting?
You know, Sharon, really, the audience is broad. Of course, foodies will be there. They'll have heard of it, and they will be there. And sometimes I think chefs, especially chefs who make really high-end foods, can be intimidating, as can their dishes, especially if you can't pronounce it. That intimidates me. So I think some people are scared away because of that. And I would really encourage everyone not to be afraid. The whole point of this is to provide education. Come talk with those chefs. Even if you can't pronounce the dish, it doesn't matter because that's all that's being served.
You're just going to taste it.
Just taste it. And then learn about, you know, where the ingredients come from. And they'll all come from Indiana. So, you know, it'll be lettuces and tomatoes and bison and perch. And you'll really learn a lot about what Indiana provides in terms of produce and meats.
I am curious about that. What is, you are kind of an insider, but what has surprised you most in putting this event together, the inaugural one last year and the sophomore effort this year? What are some of the foods that we create that people might be very surprised to learn?
You know, the yellow perch surprised me because when I think of fish, I think of coastal states or states with large lakes, and you just really don't think of Indiana in those terms. But what's really surprising is the breadth, you know, the cheeses, the fruits, the vegetables, and everyone thinks, you know, lettuce and cabbage and radishes, but Indiana produces mint. We're actually the largest mint producer in the country.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, strange things like that. We are a truly real grocery store of produce and meats, more so than a lot of other states, which makes this event easy to put together. And it really provides the chefs with a lot of ingredients, so they can be pretty creative with the dishes and the taste that they create.
What are some of the more exotic ingredients that we produce?
Wow, the cheeses have been really interesting to me because when you think cheese, you think Colby and, you know, some of this generic cheeses. But goat cheese is made extensively in Indiana, and not just goat cheese. There's, you know, 15 varieties of goat cheese, and that has been surprising to me. And a lot of the chefs will use the goat cheese in the dishes that they'll make for Dig In. You know, off the top of my head, that's the one that really surprised me the most.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's, it feels as though we've kind of hit some kind of golden spot for breweries. So many new breweries have opened over the last year or so.
It's true. And for sure, Bruges will be there, you know, based in Broad Ripple. Sun King, which has enormous popularity right now, will be there. Upland Brewery will be there. Wineries.
We're up to 2 dozen or more wineries, aren't we?
Oh, you know, actually, we're over 60.
What?
Yeah, just this morning I talked with Jeanette Merritt at the Wine Grape Council and said, we really, you know, we're looking for 8 very solid wineries. She's like, well, yeah, that could be difficult because there's more than 60 to choose from. So, and we're going to also, Sharon, just so you know, we're going to try to pair the wines and the beers with the tastes. So when you go into a tent, and it'll be a 40 by 40 tent, really a large tent, there'll probably be 4 different food options there, three, and then the fourth will either be a beer or a wine that will pair with either one or all of the food options there. So you'll also kind of learn what wines go with what and what beers go with what. And it's not like a classroom situation. You get to eat and drink and learn all at the same time. That's right, exactly.
At the exit gate, what did you learn about what kind of wine goes with it?
That's right.
What do you want people to, other than having a good time, obviously, but what do you want people to do after they leave this event? Do you want them to go to, say, your title sponsor, Marsh, and say, I fell in love with this balsam-infused goat cheese, please stock it? I mean, I'm totally fabricating something here, but is that...
Sure,
one of the outcomes?
That's absolutely a possibility. Marsh does carry a lot of those kind of local foods, which is why Marsh is eager to sponsor this event. But, you know, I think really at the end of the day, if we had to say what one thing do you want to happen, I think we want the folks to return to the restaurants that whose tastes they enjoyed the most. Restaurants, like I say, will come from around the state. It's not just Indianapolis area. And, you know, it's a neat opportunity then for the rest of the year. You have 36 different restaurants that you've had tastes from, and you can go visit and actually have a whole meal.
3 per month. I see the road trips.
There you go.
There will be some kind of handout so that you don't have to try to keep it all in your head, especially
Absolutely.
After maybe your 6th or 8th
That's right. Sample. That's right. We're going to call it a passport. I think passport's kind of a popular phrase right now. But when at the entrance to Dig In, you'll be given a passport, and it will list all the wines available that day, all the beers available, and then all of the restaurants that are there and what they're serving. So you can, you know, circle what you like the best, and, you know, especially when you have a taste of, say, the wine or the beer, and you want to go buy a glass at one of the wine or the beer tent. You know, you can don't have to try to keep the name of the wine in your head. You can circle it in your passport and then walk over and buy it. And then for the rest of the year, you know the restaurants that you whose tastes you enjoyed the most, and you can go visit them.
Do you have a favorite moment from last year?
Oh, wow, Sharon. You know, there's a lot. It's a neat, neat event. The music is good. We have local bands come and play. Favorite moment.
Too many.
You know, it's just, the whole thing is a very neat event. It really is. I mean, there's just a lot of components, the drink, the food, the music. Indiana Artisans will be there. You know, you're familiar with the Indiana Artisan Program, so we'll have a tent with them and selling chocolates and noodles and marshmallows and, again, Indiana-made foods. And those folks are neat, and they're fun to talk with, and then you can buy the product and take it home and enjoy it, too. The whole thing is neat. And the children's activities, which we're going to expand, like I say, considerably this year, will make it a lot more fun and a lot more family-friendly.
Sharon Gamble with Eric Freeman. Dig In is Sunday, August 28th, from noon to 5 at White River State Park. You can learn more at digindiana.org. That's digindiana.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Every summer, college graduates across the country ask themselves one very important question: now what? For Brant Gilmore, the answer is prison. With little thought to a career, Brant takes a job teaching GED classes to inmates at the Indiana Correctional Facility made famous by Mike Tyson. And so is the premise for author Chris Huntington's novel, Mike Tyson Slept Here. Chris is originally from Indiana, though currently is living in China, where he teaches English. Travis spoke with him when he was recently back in the States to visit family.
Chris, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in our studio, and great to have you in the country for a little bit.
Well, thanks for having me, Travis. It's really, really a great pleasure for me.
Absolutely. Let's start with just give us a brief synopsis of the story behind Mike Tyson Slept Here. A great title, by the way, especially for anyone who lives in Indiana and knows or has an idea of some of the places Mike Tyson may have slept here.
Well, this specifically refers to Plainfield Correctional Facility, which was the prison where Mike Tyson spent his time. I spent about 10 years in the prison system, and a lot of it was at that prison. I spent my time working there, teaching GD.
You weren't in prison yourself.
Right.
Right. And the story is really, I mean, loosely based on your experiences, I have to imagine. I mean, since you were teaching English in GD classes in the Plainfield prison, as is one of the main characters here.
Well, the main character of Mike Tyson Slept Here is a guy named Brant Gilmore, who gets out of college and gets turned down for the Peace Corps and still wants to save the world. And he gets involved in teaching in the prison system, helping guys who dropped out of high school learn to read, learn to do their math, learn to get their high school equivalency.
Mm-hmm.
That's not exactly my story, because I was in the Peace Corps, and then I spent about 10 years wandering around teaching international schools and stuff. So by the time I got to the prison system...
You weren't right out of college, then.
Right. I wasn't quite as nice, and I wasn't quite as girl-hungry, and I didn't have all the same issues that Brant does. But a lot of it is very similar to my experience.
Yeah. Certainly a few crossovers. I mean, the characters from Columbus, as I know, you know, you are as well. And there's also some great scenes just like, you know, hanging out at the Old Point Tavern, which was great to read about. But it's interesting. I mean, you've got this main character, but also other characters, and looking at how their lives intertwine, it makes the book quite an enjoyable read, I thought.
Well, thanks. What I wanted to do was kind of get at some of the idea that a prison is, we used to say, it's kind of like a village, because it's like a Andy Griffith Mayberry without any women or kids. But you have your own sheriff, you have your own law enforcement, you have your own medical, you have your doctor's office, you have your little store, country store, which is a commissary.
Yeah.
You have your own mail, your post office, you've got the barbershop. I mean, it's a very small world, you know, with the warden at the top. And the same, and by extension, it affects so much. It seems, in one way, it's self-contained, but in another way, it's incredibly connected to everything. Where if this day and age, if you're not in prison yourself, you probably know someone who's had some experience there. There are a lot of jobs that are based around the prison. A lot of people spend time in the prison. A lot of people are waiting for someone to come out of prison. It's got a huge footprint in our society, so I wanted to kind of capture some of that.
When you were working at Plainfield, were you consciously at that point thinking about, you know, I should be taking notes to write a book on this, or how did that process occur for you?
Well, I've been writing since, it's been my dream since I was 18 or whatever. I've been writing book after book after book, and they've always been kind of like stacking up on my desk. I was getting my master in fine arts when I was working at Plainfield. And so, I mean, I'm always thinking about what about life? What am I noticing and what seems so important? And then you hear a lot of stories and you want to tell some of these stories and, you know, and I'd say that, you know, you work in the prison, it's a conversation killer when you go to a party or you meet new people because that's all they want to talk about. And you want to find yourself telling the same kind of stories over and over. And I thought, I want to tell the story right one time, once and for all.
Huh. So, that's interesting. I mean, so when you were, you know, being asked by people like, oh, what's it like to work there? I mean, what's sort of like the typical story that comes up or that people expect? Or were you asked often about like Mike Tyson?
People, I think they expect it's going to be like Oz or like Prison Break or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
It's just not. I mean, life can't go on like that. You can't have people getting stabbed every week.
That intense.
No, yeah. I'm afraid not. It's just not. And they also think that it's going to be this cell or it's like this, your fear is you're going to be in the cell with this huge, terrible brute of a guy. And the fact is that in a medium security like Plainfield, it's you're probably not going to have a cell of your own. You're probably going to share a room with maybe 100 guys.
Yeah.
That's just how it's done.
These big dormitory spaces.
Yeah, like a dormitory space with bunks. And, you know, you the California problems now are they're closing these prisons because apparently they were not just double. I mean, they had bunk beds stacked on top of bunk beds in gymnasiums. Mm-hmm. They had way too many people. And Indiana's not like that. Indiana's much more, I don't know, I wouldn't say humane, but it's not at that level. But the fact is, you're probably not going to have a cell of your own just to put your Betty Gable post, you know, calendar up and dig your little tunnel. That's not going to happen.
Along with that, I mean, just sort of the difference in the physicality of how it's, you know, portrayed on TV as opposed to how it really is. I mean, what other big surprises did you encounter when you were working in the prison that you thought, God, I need to write about that?
I think one thing that really kind of was a revelation for me is when I first got there, I thought, man, this is such a there's so much intense drama. It's like in our literature and our culture, it's the police drama because there's so much life and death and big decisions being made.
Mm-hmm.
But in prison seemed like very much the same thing. We had these incredible life moments, you know, where your life has completely come to a stop, or you have this moment of clarity, or you have this moment of punishment and good versus evil, and people are losing big things. There's a lot on the table in terms of drama. It's not just like, I lost my car keys, I'll find them in 10 minutes. I lost my family, I lost my kids, I lost my job, I lost my pride. I mean, there's a lot of things out there. I thought, when people are dealing with this, it's got to change the way they look at the world. They must, you know, in some ways make them deep. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you have guys in the prison, they're fighting over a 29-cent thing of soup. And you mm-hmm. think, like, are you really worried about that 29-cent ramen? And they do. People do.
But at the same time, a lot of the stories here are much less focused on the inmates than the people who work there. I mean, of course, the teachers. But some of the stories that I found really kind of the most moving, one was about a guard who sort of got his dream job close to his retirement, sitting in a tower where basically, I love the comparison. He said it was like fishing. You just sort of hang out there and watch, you know, right? I mean, because not a whole lot happened.
Right, not at that level. At that yeah. level, it doesn't. If things happen to him, it's really hit the fan.
Yeah, that was just kind of that part was kind of amazing to me. And then also the story of I believe it's the nurse, and just sort of the issues she's dealing with because of a mistake that she made and the tension that's in her life. And there's, you know, and there's also, there's a lawyer too. There's a lot of other, you know, sort of stories that sort of cross over into
okay,
this.
Thanks.
But especially I think the nurse and the tower guard were the two that really stuck with me.
The nurse's story I actually heard from the inmate's point of view. But I think one thing that kind of concerns me about the prison is people have the misconception that prison is full of animals. You know, it's just these inhuman, unlikable creatures. And that's not true. I mean, there are a lot of inmates are people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're good men, bad men, most of them unhappy because of the situation. But I saw a lot of the best part of humanity than my students and other people. But I think another misconception is that if a movie or a story takes place in a prison, it's the inmate who's the hero. They've been humanized in some way or another in your drama. But the officers and the people that work in the prison are almost like Nazis. The prison guards are always animals.
Yeah.
In uniform. And you don't even know if you watch a movie or read another book, most books, I think, that you don't know that there are nurses and there are teachers and there are social workers and people that work in the prison.
At the same time, it seems like being you know, behind bars in those occupations really has a profound effect on the people who work in the prisons. I mean, you know, there's one of the guards tells a joke about, you know, what's the difference, you know, sort of, you know, the people who work there are just doing their time 8 hours at a time or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but I mean, it affects their, at least the characters in your story, their ability to trust, the way that they perceive the world.
I don't know what it's like to be a police officer, but I do feel like if you spend a lot of time behind bars, whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
you're surrounded by unhappy people and that affects you in a certain way. And then you have to be suspicious. You have to say no so much. And there's one of my colleagues talked about racial creep, you know, because in one way, like the prison is one of the most integrated institutions in our society. It's blacks and whites living together, you know, Latinos, everything. At the same time, it's obviously one of the most racially divisive places in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And people go in with all kinds of good intentions and they find themselves over time being degraded, you know. It's an ugly thing. But it's when you're self-aware and you're kind of watching things happen, it can be a funny thing too.
You can, let's talk about a very good thing, and that is the fact that I want to know how you got this book published, actually, considering that you've been, you know, living in China and teaching over there. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, sort of welcomed you back to the United States, and it's great to have you here. But, you know, you're working, you know, teaching in China right now, and living there with your family. And how'd you even manage to? I mean, it's hard enough to get a book published to begin with. But,
well, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
But
I think it's part of that is just the slow pace of publishing, and I submitted this to a contest and the Fabry Prize. Years before I actually left the DOC.
Okay.
And it just came out this year because it's taken so long for the process of publication.
And so you won the Fabry Prize.
I won the Fabry Prize, and part of that goes along with that. It was started by Dr. Matthew McKay in honor of a Holocaust survivor about people telling stories and getting stories out there in the world that changed the world. And so the book won the prize. And
congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it followed up. It's come out.
That's pretty fantastic. That's great. So at this point then, so this is published through Boaz Publishing. Mm-hmm. Now, do they always publish the Fabry winner? Is that the idea?
That's basically what they do.
They do, okay.
That's what they do.
And so then what's next then?
I'm working on a lot of different things. I don't know that I'm really going to continue the prison life. So I'm happy to kind of walk away.
Yeah, sure.
I tried to put as much as I knew in this book. I'm interested in race. I'm interested in culture. I'm interested in people get, you know, the us against them, who gets mm-hmm. included, who doesn't. So I'm working on a couple of different things.
Any temptations to write about your experiences teaching over in China right now? Or?
Well, part of it, of course, is that my family is what you call triracial. You know, I'm half Chinese. My wife is, you know, white as snow, and then my little boy's from Ethiopia. So I mean, that makes us kind of stand out a little bit here in Indiana, but certainly in China, it makes us stand out a lot.
Sure.
And it's kind of made me look at culture in different ways.
Interesting. Well, looking forward to see what you come up with next, Chris.
Well, thanks, Travis.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, congratulations on this novel and the publication of it and winning the Fabry Prize. Mike Tyson slept here. And just one clarification, except for really kind of one scene, Mike Tyson really is not a character in this book at all.
No, he's not. He's absolutely not. But it's one of those things where he's the most famous person to ever go through there. So I think a lot of people kind of attach themselves to that name in a way that, you know, like if you find yourself in that position of spending a piece of your life in that place,
mm-hmm.
and you think, well, I really kind of messed things up for myself, but, you know, Mike Tyson was here, and he was successful, you know. And, and it's also, it's the whole reversal. And someone, Mike Tyson, at one point in the world, I remember when I'm about the same age he was, and there was always a point where I was like, man, I'm messed up. He's my age, and he's done so much that I haven't. He's so successful.
Sure.
He's unstoppable. He's invincible. He just seemed like he was the king of the world. And you realize now, you know, looking back, that he had a lot of problems, and he's not the king of the world. And he fell just like anyone else.
Yeah, very, very humanized and kind of a little bit of a strange beacon of hope there. But anyway, Chris, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter. It's been great chatting with you, and really enjoyed reading Mike Tyson Slept Here.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure for me, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with author Chris Huntington. His novel, Mike Tyson Slept Here, was recently published by Boaz Publishing and is the winner of the 3rd Fabry Literary Prize. His book is available at Big Hat Books in Broad Ripple. Visit ChrisHuntingtonOnline.com for more information. Chris with a C-H, ChrisHuntingtonOnline.com for more information. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Moo.
Oh.
You know what the hissing is?
I hope it's not the cow.
It's a male llama.
Oh, of course.
They
very
hiss
well
when
done.
Upset.
Wow. You must have been out to the state fair.
I have been to the state fair. I've been learning more about animals. Uh-huh. And let me see, how am I going to connect this to our arts calendar?
Yeah.
There's lots to see and do at the state fair and
That's
experience,
right.
including that awesome Douglas David exhibit that we heard about through your interview recently.
That's right.
And we have other things to do on our calendar we
call
What Do We Moo?
Oh, wow. The state fair edition?
State fair time.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's right. Well, Douglas David is the official artist of the fair with his exhibit Paints Farm to Fair, which is in the Normandy barn, the Normandy barn through August 21st. What else do you have going on at the state fair?
We're moving on. Well, actually, this isn't at the state fair, but you know how it's been so beastly hot this summer?
Mm-hmm.
That helped the Children's Museum of Indianapolis set an all-time attendance high this July, 13% higher than a five-year average, 25% higher than a five-year average.
How fun.
If you drop the specially ticketed King Tut exhibit. So, yeah. So, and a lot of new people were exposed to the Children's Museum because of the heat wave. So, yay.
There you go.
It's a good thing.
Well, I actually do have some more state fair stuff going on, including the National Barn Dance that they have had the past couple of years in the Pioneer Village, which is located in Possum Holler, and it's part of the northeast corner of the state fairgrounds, and they're having lots of fun shows, including a sort of a National Barn Dance WLS Old Time Radio Tribute Show that is actually going on this weekend, Saturday at 3 p.m. and again at 7 p.m. But also there's lots of great musicians. Mac Bellner's out there, as well as a whole bunch of storytellers in the White River Jazz Band, and a group called Blackberry Jam, a folk group, all types of stuff going on throughout the entire state fair at the Pioneer Village. Definitely worth checking out.
Don't forget to visit the Germany Pavilion And also, one of my favorite parts of the State Fair is the photography exhibit. And remember, there are categories for amateurs as well as professional photographers. Lots of gorgeous, gorgeous photos there.
Very cool.
Yeah. There is a new exhibit at the Stutz Art Space that just opened last week at First Friday, and it features figurative paintings by Travis S. Little. Little started Homage Studios to manage and market his fine art, illustration, photography, and interactive media work. And this is kind of a best of show representing a lot of his talents.
And he is very talented.
He is very talented. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful work.
Great technique.
Stutz Art Space, if you don't know, is inside the Stutz Building. And yes, you don't forget, you can go to the Stutz Building even when it's not the spring open house. And you can see specifically these works from 11 to 2 weekdays or by appointment. And the exhibition is up through August 26th, so most of the month.
There's still about a couple weeks left for Animals and All That Jazz at the zoo. There's great concerts on Thursday nights at the zoo that are always fun and worth checking out. But also coming up on Thursday, August 25th, the Naturally Inspired Silent Auction Artist Reception for the zoo's big annual end of the summer art fair. And this is featuring the work of, I think, about 25 or so different artists with a plein air juried art show that all takes place at the zoo, and artists painting animals at the zoo, and it should all be a lot of fun. If you go to the Indy Zoo's website, you can find out information about that. Should be a good time.
Very good. Hey, I want to remind you that even though it hasn't started just yet, now is the time to get online at indiefringe.org and plan your attack for the Indy Fringe Festival, which starts next weekend. Yeah, absolutely. There's so many great sounding shows this year. You really do need to kind of figure out your schedule, because there are more venues than ever, including the Indiana Landmark Center, which is hosting a number of venues, including the Intimate Opera Company. So lots of things to see and do. Go to indiefringe.org and you can print out a schedule and see what you need to do.
So much to see with Indy Fringe. Can't wait. Hey, artists out there, there's a deadline of August 15th for a call from proposals from IDATA. That's the Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association, and they are looking for artists who want to participate in a visual arts pavilion that they are putting together for the Super Bowl, which is going to be really cool. They're working closely with the host committee and the Arts Council and the mayor's office to create the IDATA Art Pavilion, and if you want to be a part of it, you need to get your information into them right away. So go online and check out idataartpavilion.com for more information.
Very good. Hey, I have some road trips. If you have kids in IPS, they're back to school and perhaps they're out of your hair. But if the thought of getting kids back to school makes you think of more autumnal activities, like corn mazes, yes, it's not too soon to go to a corn maze. Actually, this one opens August 26th and runs through October 30th. It's in Lafayette at Exploration Acres, and it is described as an agricultural explosion. It's an 18-acre corn maze with over 8 miles of twists and turns, and you can test your skill at a pedal car race, fire a three-ear corn cannon salute, mine for your very own gems, and pick a pumpkin, or just dive into a mound of hay. And there's food opportunities as well. You can have your own pit fire and roast hot dogs and marshmallows. So it's a great acoustic activity, as they're billing it. Exploration Corn Maze at Exploration Acres in Lafayette.
Very cool. Hey, the Carmel Community Players has some great stuff going on this weekend, featuring the talents of lots of local performers as part of their Lights, Camera, Cabaret. It's their fifth community-based talent showcase, and it is going on all weekend at the Carmel Community Playhouse in Clay Terrace Boulevard. And amongst the people performing, Gail Payne will be up there. So have a great time, Gail, and I hope everyone has a great show, and break a leg.
All right, very fun. The Hoosier Schoolmaster is a 1935 film with Norman Foster and Otis Harlan. It's based on an Edward Eggleston's novel, very loosely based, according to our local film guy, Eric Grayson, who calls it a lousy adaptation of the novel, but the film works pretty well on its own terms. There's a recently discharged soldier charged with teaching school in rural Indiana, a love triangle thrown into the mix. And everything is resolved by the climactic, are you ready for it? Spelling bee.
Of course.
It's a rare 16-millimeter print, one of the only ones still in existence. And you can see it Saturday night, August 20th at 8 o'clock for just $3 at Garfield Park.
Very cool. Hey, last thing, Sharon, for our calendar this week that I want to let people know about. It's not actually an event, but it's more of a big thumbs up and congratulations to the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, because they announced last week that they are offering free copies of Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five to all the students in the school in Republic, Missouri, where the book was recently banned. It's a high school that has chosen to ban Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, and so through the generosity of the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, all of those students who want to have a copy of the book are going to be able to get a copy of the book. If you want to participate in this or just support the Vonnegut Library or send a copy of the book off to Missouri, you can go to vonnegutlibrary.org. But kudos to them.
Mr. Vonnegut would be so proud. Well done. Well done.
Well, enjoy the fair, and we will be back next week with more of
What'll We Moo?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Spades Park on Indy's Near East Side will once again be lit up by hundreds of paper lanterns on Saturday, August 27th, during the Feast of Lanterns. This year, the organizers have added new elements, and Sharon Gamble found out more from Scott Wiederoder, Ken Holyoke, Tom Sisson, and Greg O'Haver.
Well, gentlemen, because we have four lovely men here, and because it's radio and they can't see you, I'm going to have you introduce yourselves and say how you first became aware of Feast of Lanterns.
My name is Scott Wiederoder, and a friend of ours in the neighborhood in Emerson Heights said that NESCO, which is the Near East Side Community Organization, had a wonderful festival. And my wife and I were not really festival goers, and we were using the excuse to stay in out of the house, and he drug us there anyway. And it was kind of love at first sight. I believe that was in 2007.
That's a good start.
Well, I've heard of the festival.
Are you?
I'm Greg O'Haver.
All right.
I'm a new Christie minstrel, or an old Christie minstrel, as a fact. But I've heard of the festival. I've never been to it. Scott is my buddy, and Scott made me a little more aware of it. And looking forward to it this year.
Good deal.
I'm Ken Holyoke. I happened on the Near East Side about 10 years ago, helping out in the church, and ended up on the NESCO board and got involved in the feast because it sounded like fun and didn't seem to be too hard work. It turns out it is a lot of hard work, but I've done about four of them now, and it's getting to be habitual, and it's fun.
Yeah. And Tom?
Hi, I'm Tom Sisson. I moved to the area about 6 years ago. About a year and a half after I moved in, I heard about the Feast of Lanterns. I lived in Little Flower neighborhood and thought that the neighborhood should be more involved. Just kind of showed up, did stuff, and next thing you knew, I was on the committee.
Let this be a lesson to you, gentle listeners. If you show up and are enthusiastic about something, you might just end up with a volunteer gig. And, you know, it's public radio. Our listeners know that. It's a good thing. So I guess I should ask for people who haven't been, and there might be a few people who haven't been, what is Feast of Lanterns? When did it start? And when did it get started again? I'm not sure who the best person to address this is.
Well, the original Feast of Lanterns was 1908. And it was the Brookside Civic League and several other organizations kind of tossed it around for a while. But the Brookside Festival seemed to be the one that survived and flourished. There are accounts in the Indianapolis Star of there being up to 23,000 visitors descended upon the park.
Wow, it's not that big a park. So
no,
that's astonishing.
But the festival had a tendency to spread out. Tradition had it that all the houses in the neighborhood hung lanterns on their porch, and it was a day-long event. And it continued pretty much up until World War II became kind of intermittent. And like a lot of things, the country was in a time of turmoil, and it was dropped from activity.
And the lanterns at the time were lit by candles mostly, because this is 1908. Not everybody had electricity.
But there were some houses that had electricity. But the park itself, they were lit by candles, mm-hmm. which is quite a challenge with paper lanterns.
Absolutely. A timing issue, too, getting them all going at once. How did it get restarted? I know that there were some people on the Near East Side who were involved in this. Do we know?
In about 2001, a couple gentlemen and ladies got together, and we were conducting a festival that was kind of an informal get-together at Brookside Park.
Mm-hmm.
But someone thought that we needed something a little more. And so they did their research together with the historic committee and found out about the original Feast of Lanterns and thought it was time to bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
They worked for almost a year and then brought in the first Feast of Lanterns. So this is the ninth one, so 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a success, but quite small at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
And has continued to grow to our ninth year this year.
Now, I know that it's a lot of Near East Siders who are involved, but I know your volunteer corps extends beyond the Near East Side. And, of course, your audience extends. You know, everybody's invited to Feast of Lanterns, right?
Oh,
yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. And Spades Park, which is a sweet little neighborhood park, right next to the Spades Library, a beautiful little arts and crafts library. One of, if I recall correctly, isn't it one of the two Carnegie libraries?
It's one of the two Carnegie libraries, mm-hmm. and it's something we need to preserve.
Absolutely. The trees are lit at night with hundreds of lanterns that are, all of which are made by volunteers, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. But the feast itself, the celebration goes on all day, and you've added some new elements this year. Who's Charles in charge of the feast ball, the lantern ball?
The lantern ball is a new event because this is the 2011-2012 Super Bowl legacy year. There were a lot of people who wanted to enlarge it, realizing that we have hundreds of volunteers who take their time off of work. We had to find a way to extend the event without overtaxing, you know, the people.
Sure.
American Senior Communities was gracious enough to give us a grant to ground the ball, and this year we have a 2,400 square foot party tent. The ball is the night before.
Wait, 2,400 square foot party tent?
That's correct.
That's enormous.
It is, but we've hopefully 400 of our closest friends will come and support the lantern ball. It is a fundraiser. It's $10
mm-hmm.
per person.
Mm-hmm.
We have a mini concert by the Good Time Singers. We have
kind of music is Good Time Singers?
Good Time Singers is a group that was started by Elizabeth Good. She's 97 or 98 years old.
Love it.
All the members are retired. That's the only requirement to be in it, besides loving music. That will be followed by ballroom dancing by the White River Jazz Club, who is a part of the Indianapolis Jazz Club. And then we will have salsa. Andy
Ooh.
Salsa and Marcus Gunter will bring an exhibition group and give some quick lessons, and we'll salsa the night away.
Fantastic. So you burn off the calories so that when you come back for the feast the next day and you eat.
That is correct. And we have wonderful food.
What kind of food?
We have all local vendors. It's everything from pulled pork barbecue that's cooked on the spit to pizza, bratwurst, Italian sausage, breaded tenderloins, lemon shake-ups, blooming onions, fish and chips. It goes on and on.
It's all good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I skipped over something, which is another new element, the Saturday morning parade, right?
Yes. and, of course, don't forget there's going to be vegetarian fare available at the festival.
Important
so
to note.
You
yeah.
don't have to eat meat. There's plenty to eat. The parade actually ran the first year, but it was very informal. It was just a group of neighbors sort of walking festively towards the event.
I love it.
And anyone could join, and yes, there were people kind of dressed up, but there wasn't really enough people and organization to keep both the parade and the festival. So people keep asking, when are we going to have the parade? And I thought, I'll do it. And that's what I did. Never speak up.
You know, it is kind of unusual to have a room full of four guy volunteers. It's usually the women who don't step back fast enough when they ask for volunteers. I applaud you. You're representing your gender well here.
Well, there are actually women involved, but many of them are at work and have other engagements.
Sure.
Many of us are either between jobs, semi-retired, mm-hmm. or between gigs. I'm a church student. But the parade itself is an event that will start on the Near East Side at approximately 10th and Rural. We're trying to kick off at about 10:30 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We will go west to Arsenal Avenue, and then we will go north on Arsenal, and then veer over on Commerce, and then Noland, and end up right at the park to kick off the festival at noon.
And it'll include some neighbors. It'll include, do I understand that you're recruiting some classic cars as well?
Yes, we have made arrangements with a gentleman whose name I cannot remember, so I apologize. Ruth Shaw, who is assisting me, had arranged that, and we will use that for various VIPs and dignitaries. And of course, in the parade, there will be neighborhood involvement, not as much as I'd like, but a reminder to those listeners that if you're in the neighborhood, please get involved.
Yeah.
And of course, being the place that it is, there is an election coming. There are candidates for office and current office holders, including Mayor Greg Ballard, candidate Melina Kennedy, Ms. Bro, who represents part of the Near East Side,
mm-hmm.
Zach Adamson, who's running for an at-large candidate who is from the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
And some promises from various other people of the Republican and Democratic parties who have not yet confirmed.
You're not going to name names and put pressure on them on the air here. That's wise. Very smart.
The mayor, being the Marine that he is walking in the parade.
Of course he is. It's probably going to be...
He declined the convertible.
Oh, bless his heart. And forget about the heat. So there will be entertainment beyond encountering the parade and talking with politicians. What can we expect entertainment-wise? I know it's been all over the map, style and genre, in the past.
Well, it has gone from one stage that was the Indy Park stage. That was fortunately condemned and scrapped, which forced us to step up and put a professional stage in. We now have two live stages of entertainment. All of the bands are very high quality. The community stage has local schools, local talent, gospel, mainstream local performers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Main Street stage has the rock and roll, the blues, the folk songs, and of course this year we have the New Christy Minstrels as our headliner, and this is their 50th year.
Oh my
gosh.
And
I can let Greg O'Haver, who is a member,
I want to hear
pick up on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're too young to have been with the group 50 years.
Well, just barely. I remember going and seeing them when I was a senior in high school, and I'm an East Sider. I went to Howe, grew up around Emerson 10th. So I was very much involved in folk music at the time, but I was not on the West Coast. So,
did you have your own band?
I had bands through the years. Probably the most well-known was a group called Pleasant Street in the late 60s and through the mid-70s.
Folk pop?
It was folk, pop, rock, country mixture of all kinds of stuff. And I had just come back from California at the time, where I'd worked for Randy Sparks. And Randy is the man that started the New Christy Minstrels, as well as the Carpenters and Steve Martin and Kenny Rogers and...
Pretty good credentials there.
Lots of people. He was the guy back in the 60s in L.A. So I'd worked for Randy back in the 60s.
How'd you get involved with the New Christy Minstrels?
Well, I'd been offered a job with them back in the early 70s and did not want to do it at the time. But again, my association with Randy, about a year and a half ago, my wife passed away. She, within about a month, Randy called me and asked me if I wanted to get out of the house. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, we've been running 7 people on the road. I think we'll run 8. And so that was it.
What's your touring schedule like? How often are you out?
Typically, we're out every month for short runs. Last fall, we did 34 concerts in 54 days from West Coast to East Coast, back through the Midwest, and back and forth, back and forth. That's the longest one we've been on.
It takes a lot of energy.
It does, but amazingly, Randy has put together a group of people that work well together, and we love each other. We just love being out on the road with each other. You wake up in the morning laughing, and you go to bed laughing at night.
You're a family.
Yeah, very much so. And we had just a great time. And it's a great mixture of folks.
What kind of music will you be performing at the feast?
Well, we'll be doing all of our hit songs from the 60s, Green Green, Today, Saturday Night, things like that. Everybody in the group solos. It's a group of solo artists. So everybody does solos, and everybody's actually capable of doing the show by themselves. But we don't want to.
Sharon Gamble with Scott Wiederoder, Ken Holyoke, Tom Sisson, and Greg O'Haver. The Feast of Lanterns is the last weekend of August, with the big event on Saturday, August 27th in Spades Park on the near east side of Indianapolis. And Mark Miles will be the Grand Marshal of the Feast Parade on Saturday morning. Find out more at indiefeast.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4, when I'll find out about the intimate opera at the Indie Fringe and also chat with Lou Harry about his Fringe show for this year. And I'll get a preview of the Midwest Garden Writers Conference.
So it's an all Sharon show. Well, we will have our arts calendar as well that we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium now through August. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.